Here is a question for which there is really no one right answer. What do you think about this economy right now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is Thursday today, the 9th day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. To begin today, a little piece of audio, a mere 12 seconds, not too long, won't be too painful, but inside it, there is a whole lot to digest. Here you go.
I believe that monetary policy is in a good place and should continue to support sustained growth, a strong labor market, and inflation running close to our symmetric 2% objective.
Those of you who recognize that to be a member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, not too tough, really, given the subject matter, go to the head of the class. If you identify the speaker as Richard Clarida, the vice chairman of the Fed, a gold star to you. Now, why are we starting with him? Well, a couple of reasons, honestly. Number one, because the Fed has been taking some heat lately for having gotten a lot of its economic forecasting wrong. Hello, inflation. Number two, because Clarida said today, and Chair Powell says often, that really the economy's pretty good. And number three, because Pew is out with a study today that says not everybody out in the actual economy agrees with the Fed. So two interviews with which to test those premises. First, about the Fed, Sarah Binder. She's a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she studies the Fed. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you make of the vice chairman's speech today and more importantly, how the Fed sort of is positioning itself in this economy right now?
Well, the Fed is saying, so far, so good. The economy's on a good track. Congress has given us a dual mandate of low sustainable unemployment and low inflation, and we're hitting them. He's not telling us really where things are going in the future. He's saying data dependent, meeting by meeting, but he's telling us the economy is on a good course.
He said, and Chair Powell says this all the time, that they're going to, you know, work to keep the expansion going as long as they can. And one of the things Chair Powell says, and Clarida said it today, was that, you know, the longer the expansion goes, the more it helps people at the bottom. How much can the Fed really do, though, for the people at the bottom of this economy?
Well, the Fed so far is doing a lot by keeping monetary policy so loose and accommodative, right? And you see wage gains at the lower end of the economic spectrum. At a certain point, though, there's only so much that monetary policy can do. And absent fiscal policy that might, say, deal with job training or job relocation or health care, there's only so much weight that can be put on monetary policymakers.
Let me carry that forward to an interview we're going to have here in a couple of minutes with a pollster from Pew who has a new study out today about economic inequality in this country. What can the Fed do on economic inequality, which consistently ranks pretty high in terms of what people are worried about in this economy?
Well, the best contribution they can make is to keep an eye on employment and do as much as they can to stoke job growth, but without sparking inflation. Keeping an eye on the health of the financial system so that people have access to liquidity and so forth. At the end of the day, though, it's really the limits of what monetary policymakers can do.
The really simple line is heading into an election year, right, is it's the economy, stupid. Frame that for me in terms of the Federal Reserve and the role of the economy in the next 11 months of our common experience.
Well, Congress gives the Fed two commands: keep inflation low, keep jobs growing.
Right.
That's what the Fed is aiming to do here. And to the extent that they're successful, it means the economy is growing and on an even keel. And that's what helps incumbents get reelected.
Sarah Binder, she's at Brookings, also a professor of political science at George Washington University. Professor, thanks for your time, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so all of that said, interview number two now from the Pew Research Center, whose study out today shows, as I said, that not everybody agrees that the economy is all sunshine and light. Ruth Agelnik, she is a senior researcher at Pew. Ruth, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
If I say that 70% of respondents to this survey that y'all did, if I say that they believe the economy is rigged, is that too strong a word?
I would say that they think that the economy is unfairly favoring powerful special interests. So we asked whether the economy was generally fair or whether it unfairly favored these powerful interests, and 7 in 10 Americans said that they did not think it was fair.
We should point out there is a partisan divide here, as with most things in this country now.
That's right. Republicans are about evenly split, with about half of Republicans saying the economy is generally fair and half of the economy saying it unfairly favors these special interests, whereas Democrats sort of overwhelmingly say that the economy is not fair.
Yeah. Okay, so brass tacks here. Who's got the power?
So we asked Americans who they thought had too much power and influence in today's economy, and about 8 in 10 or more Americans said that politicians, large corporations, and people who were wealthy had too much power. We also had majorities saying health insurance companies, banks, and other financial institutions, and tech companies had too much power.
Let me ask you then, who doesn't have the power, or is powerless, I suppose, is another way to put it.
Yeah, we asked who people felt did not have enough power, and Americans pointed to people who were poor, the middle class, and interestingly, small businesses.
Yeah, say more about that, because when I read this and small businesses came up, that's the thing that got me on the phone with you, to be honest.
Yeah, and one interesting thing was we saw a partisan divide in how Democrats and Republicans looked at a number of these groups. Republicans were less likely than Democrats to say that large corporations had too much power. But when it came to small businesses, Democrats and Republicans were largely in agreement that small businesses did not have enough power in today's economy.
So what else do people need to know about this? I mean, as they read this and they hear that, you know, 7 in 10 people think the economy is unbalanced, shall we say, instead of rigged, what are they supposed to do with that information?
It's hard to say what people are supposed to do. In this survey, we did sort of dive into what Americans think about economic inequality in general. And while most Americans say that there's too much economic inequality in the country, they didn't rank it particularly highly as an issue. So it's hard to sort of say how that will play out.
Ruth Agelnik, she's a senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. Ruth, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So which one of those points of view do you think Wall Street traders went with today, huh? The Feds or Pews? We'll have the details and the answer and some record highs, which I guess is an answer when we do the numbers. Talk about credit a good deal on the program, mostly the debt markets, bonds. Today, cards, credit cards, and how banks and card issuers are trying to adjust to this changing economy. Chase said this week it's going to be raising the annual fee on its premium credit card, Sapphire Reserve, it's called. The fee is going up $100 to $550 all told. Not cheap, but it's also not like Chase is the first to bump its top-line cards. American Express and Citi have done the same, betting that users are still going to think the rewards are worth the costs. Rewards that are, by the way, beginning to change, as Marketplace's Justin Ho explains.
Chase will keep the Reserve's $300 travel credit, and it's offering a few new perks. Discounts at the food delivery service DoorDash, a year of cheaper Lyft rides. Andrew Davidson at the research firm Compra Media says it's a sign Chase is ratcheting up the competition for young people's business.
Trying to offer a lifestyle and meet the needs of young consumers and how they live their lives today.
Chase isn't the only bank appealing to the stereotypical, convenience-driven millennial. American Express's Platinum card offers $200 in Uber credits. Davidson says non-premium cards are starting to offer lifestyle benefits, too.
Wells Fargo offers additional cash back on things like streaming and ride-sharing. You now have the Apple card as well that offers 3% back at Uber.
Hiking an annual fee can help a bank recoup some of the costs of reward programs and sign-up bonuses, says Matt Schultz at CompareCards.com.
These rewards aren't free, and they definitely hit the banks on their bottom line.
For customers to hold on to these expensive cards, they'll have to, you know, actually want to use those lifestyle services. Michael Smart got a Chase Sapphire Reserve card 3 years ago. He's 29, lives in San Francisco, but he's a little skeptical about paying another $100 a year for the new benefits.
DoorDash, I never loved the interface, never loved the app, and now I feel like I need to like use this credit, otherwise I'm not getting the benefit of the card, and I don't like feeling that way.
Smart says he'll hang on to the card for now, but if the rewards don't seem worth it, he'll probably downgrade to a cheaper card. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, there are more than 2 million people in this country living behind bars, closer to 2.2 million, actually. Many of these people are dealing with some form of mental illness, and corrections officials are required by law to provide for their health care needs. Now, this is a raw way to say this, but that is a market opportunity for pharmaceutical companies, which is the subject of a story in The Atlantic. Max Blau wrote it about how drug makers are doing some very specific marketing to tap into that market, including at conferences about medical care in correctional facilities. Max, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
One of the interesting things that caught my eye way up high in this piece is that this was a conference sponsored by a company, an overseas company that makes one of these long-acting psychiatric drugs, right?
Yeah, it was sponsored by a company called Alkermes. Most people will know Alkermes through another drug of theirs, which is called Vivitrol, which is a popular drug used to treat opioid addiction.
Now, we should say here, and you say this in the piece, that there are doctors and medical professionals involved in the various steps of getting these medications. But in a lot of cases, judges are making the decisions, right? And sheriffs are carrying them out. The pitch is what? What's the benefit, I suppose, of these treatments, specifically the one at this conference about long-term psychiatric care?
There's a high percentage of people who have schizophrenia behind bars that don't take their daily oral medications, that could potentially be unsafe for the patient themselves in terms of them not getting the exact care, as well as potentially for other guards or other people who are also serving time behind bars. Mm-hmm. So in addition to that, there's also, you know, at a time when drug prices are rising and budgets for jails and prisons aren't, or in some cases are shrinking, that having free samples of a drug, which is being offered by some of the companies, is a cost-saving measure as well.
This is a subject not without ethical concerns, right? You've got people behind bars who have been deprived of their liberty, in some cases being given medication on the orders of a judge. Discuss that for me a little bit, would you?
When you talk to people who are medical ethicists or criminal justice advocates, one of the big things that they note with healthcare and jails is that there's the issue of patient autonomy. David Fati at the ACLU handles lawsuits in prisons across the country. One of the things he expressed was this idea that if you are behind bars, one, you don't have the ability to seek a new healthcare provider. And it's truly, as he puts it, a quote unquote captive market. And second, the other issue is one that of patient autonomy, that if you are in a facility where virtually every facet of your life is controlled by someone who has power above you, can you really make a healthcare decision that is chosen for the patient and is in their best intention?
Part of the reason that this medication is so important, and again, specifically for long-term psychiatric patients, is that it when they get out and they're on these long-acting anti-schizophrenia medications, they tend not to reoffend, right? There's the greater social benefit here.
Absolutely. One of the major risk factors related to recidivism is whether or not you have continuity of care from the point of being released to getting, you know, through your first few months and getting connected with healthcare providers. So one of the ideas as to why this might work, particularly for people behind bars, is that if you can give someone a 30-day or a 60-day shot that lasts that long on their way out of a correctional facility, that's going to buy them some time to potentially stay on a drug and get connected with the provider that's going to help you get long-term care.
And in theory, stay out of jail, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Max Blau, writing in The Atlantic about psychiatric drugs to the incarcerated population in this country. Max, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
you can relate to their problems, you can relate to their motives.
Also, they're profitable. Another side of the streaming wars straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. So here you go. Shooting war in the Middle East is 48 hours behind us. Dow Industrial's up 211 points, 0.75%, 28,956. Dow 29,000. Not far away. The NASDAQ up 74 points, 0.8%, 9,203. The S&P 500 up 21 points, 0.6%, 3,274. Record highs all over the place. Justin was talking about credit cards. So here you go. Chase gained a third of 1% today. Citi banked nearly 1%. Get it? Citi banked? I like that one. American Express better off, up 1.8% today. Bank of America took home 1.1%. In other news, Snap, parent company of Snapchat, received an upgrade to buy from financial services firm Jefferies. Buying was had. Snap shares up 4% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus fell. That's the way that works. Down to 1.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. You want to spend more time with Marketplace? Connect with us and the other folks who make this show work. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Marketplace. You can find us at Marketplace APM on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram.
Fast. Marketplace helps you keep up with our Alexa skill. Just say, make me smart on any Echo device, and hear something new explained every day from Molly Wood and Kai Ryssdal. Everything from how streaming music works to whatever happened to the $1,000 bill. Say, make me smart on any Echo device to get started.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A woman named Ellen Weintraub tweeted something interesting this morning. There are, yes, probably many Ellen Weintraubs out there, but this one happens to be a member of the Federal Election Commission. And what she said in her tweet was this, quote, "I am not willing to bet the 2020 elections on the proposition that Facebook has solved its problems with a solution whose chief feature appears to be that it doesn't seriously impact the company's profit margins." Number one, ouch. Number two, what Ms. Weintraub was talking about was Facebook's most recent venture through the political advertising morass, specifically that unlike Twitter, which has blocked political ads, and Google, which is going to limit ad targeting, Facebook is going to roll out some user controls, but otherwise not too terribly much. Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech. She is also our go-to for these "What Has Facebook Done Now?" conversations. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So Facebook is, I think, by my count, like tripling down on this political ads thing. There was a speech by Zuckerberg a number of months ago. Others have said similar things. Why are they digging in their heels?
Yeah, almost infinity down at this point. You know, this is one of the few issues, actually, that I think you can say Facebook has been really consistent on, which is that it does not want to police content, full stop. And, you know, in a way, I think that's fine. It's not their job. It's not particularly appropriate for a private company CEO to decide what is true or not true from political candidates, by the way, all over the globe, not just in the United States. It's complicated, and I can see why from their perspective. In fact, you had a Facebook executive write an internal note that was leaked earlier this week saying, you know, yeah, I think Facebook did in some ways decide the 2016 election, not because of truth or untruth or even micro-targeting, but because the Donald Trump campaign took better advantage of this platform than any campaign in history. That is their view. But in terms of technology, it does come down to ad targeting, and that is something that they could control.
So explain that a little bit, because honestly, it's a tad bit of a black box, right?
It's very much a black box. We don't know the extent to which you can target users on Facebook, but we do know that it is called often micro-targeting, that you can pay for an ad that can literally target an audience as small as just 20 people. And so when Facebook makes the argument that they're going to stay out of deciding what is true or not true in a political ad, that's fine. But part of their argument is everybody will be able to see that this political candidate lied, and then it will police itself by being a part of the public commons. That's true as long as these ads are in the public commons. You know, some of them do show up in Facebook's political ad database, but it doesn't show the extent to which they were targeted. And the other side of that is Google saying, you can only target, let's say, women, Democrats, voters, but you can't make it so specific that a tiny group of people see the same lies and totally believe them.
Yeah, but so how much of this, though, is Facebook pushing it down to the end user, right? Because now it's up to me again to go through my privacy settings and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And I think that is the thing that's so difficult here. On the one hand, they really could make tweaks to the micro-targeting. On the other hand, Facebook has a long history of promising us consumers all this control and either not delivering or making it 30 steps deep. And so we never end up exercising that option.
Right. Exactly. Okay. To Ms. Weintraub's point, which is that Facebook now is having its cake of not having to deal with regulating content, but also eating its profits, as it were. It's having it both ways.
Yeah, and the money is getting bigger and bigger. I mean, it used to be fairly reasonable when Facebook would say, you know, this isn't even that much money. We don't know why it's such a big deal. The predictions for political ad spending now in 2020, just 2020, range from $6 billion to $9 billion. And so it is easy, even if you sort of believe this sort of libertarian viewpoint that consumers and voters should be able to decide what's true and not true from their candidates, there's enough money here at stake that it muddies the message.
Just a tiny little bit. Marketplace's Molly Wood. She does Marketplace Tech, also with me, a podcast called Make Me Smart. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
The content wars are on, as you know, the streaming content wars specifically. Netflix, HBO Max, Disney Plus, and all the rest are spending billions of dollars to get new customers. And yes, the biggies like The Irishman and The Mandalorian are getting all the press, but pull back for a minute and think of all the possible streaming customers, because those companies certainly are. And they have been quietly investing in a genre that's got a passionate, a young, and an international audience. Anime, Japanese animation. Marketplace's Jasmine Garz reports.
This might just be the new battle cry in the streaming wars.
Father, why did you send for me?
We just told you why.
So then, I'm supposed to jump inside and fight whatever I saw out there?
Correct.
That's a scene from Neon Genesis Evangelion, an anime classic. It's filled with dark, post-apocalyptic skies, looming monsters, and its hero is a small, sensitive teenage boy, Shinji Ikari.
After all this time, why now? You left me because I was no use to you, right?
Evangelion is also an epic tale about a strained father-son relationship. And this is part of anime's charm. It's filled with symbolism, the storylines are complex, and the characters aren't your standard issue superheroes. They're flawed, just like us.
One of the main reasons I got into anime, you see like these main characters, you can relate to their problems, you can relate to their motives.
That's 16-year-old Taj John. I joined him in Brooklyn after school to watch Evangelion on Netflix. Like so many anime series, it's a never-ending saga. And this is just one anime John follows.
I discovered it when I was like, about 5 years old, and I just became addicted to the medium.
John's school notebooks are filled with drawings, and he wants to study animation in college. This is why streaming services are hungry to sign up young viewers like him. Last year, HBO Max signed a landmark anime deal with Japan's Oscar-winning Studio Ghibli. Hulu has a deal with anime powerhouse Funimation. And Netflix is premiering two more original anime series just this month, soon to be followed by the much-awaited new version of Ghost in the Shell. It's about Tokyo after the collapse of global capitalism. And a cyborg.
23 minutes ago, her brain was hacked into through a data line. Foreign intelligence warned us about this.
It ain't the Little Mermaid. John Derderian is Netflix's head of content for Japan.
Anime is, I would say, one of the most dispersed global phenomenons there is. I mean, really, we see audience for anime in every single country we operate in.
An audience with potential to grow. And to get in on that, Netflix is relying on the strategy it helped perfect, the algorithm.
We like to call it the anime fan that doesn't know they're an anime fan. Say we see someone who's a big sci-fi fan. If we can suggest to them Ghost in the Shell or Evangelion, they might like that.
And it could become yet another way to lock in international audiences and all that growth potential. Michael Pachter is an analyst with Wedbush Securities.
Anime is proof that they're going to try everything until they figure out what works. Is Netflix going to spend more and greenlight even more stuff because they're desperate?
More stuff doesn't look like desperation to Taj John back in Brooklyn watching Evangelion. All these companies going at each other just means more anime for him. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which will constitute the second and last mention of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex on this program. Madame Tussauds in London announced today that it has removed Harry and Meghan's wax figures from its royal family display. Said the museum in a tweet, "We've got to respect their wishes." Shrug emoji. For those of you thinking, as did I, ouch, that's cold, museum said they're just going to put them somewhere else, not yank them completely. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 211 today, 0.75%. NASDAQ up 74 points, 0.8%. S&P 500 up 21. That is about 0.6%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.